Hello, and welcome to One-on-One with Robert Doerr. I'm your host, Robert Doerr, and thanks for tuning in today. As president of the American Enterprise Institute, I have the unique privilege of working with America's greatest policy experts. These scholars focus on policy issues in the fields of education, economics, energy, foreign and defense, and so much more. Subscribe to this podcast for exclusive access to in-depth discussions on the most pressing policy issues. Together with my guests, we'll challenge political preconceptions, explore innovative ideas, and create, I hope, a freer and safer world. This week's guest is Nat Malkus, an AEI scholar in education. He's been here for some years and has developed an enormously outstanding reputation in the education field for being solid and spectacular on the data. And it's just been a joy to have him in our institution, and he's in this group that's led by Rick Hess, but really Nat Malkus is driving the ship, it looks like, to me, of late. Rick will love hearing that.
He'll love hearing that.
So, Nat, welcome. Thank you for being here, and thank you for doing all this work. And the work that you've gotten a lot of attention for in the last year or so is the way in which you've used a very elaborate data set and a collection of data to document the rise of chronic absenteeism in the United States in K through 12 education. And I don't want to get into how you assemble the data set quite yet, but what I want to first start out with is the definition of chronic absenteeism. What is it? And then I don't want to talk about the past. I want to talk about right now. We'll talk about COVID and the causes and where it came from and how much little or more it's better than it used to be. But right now, because it's still a problem. So definition of chronic absenteeism and how bad is it right now?
So the definition of chronic absenteeism, it's the percentage of students who miss 10% of the school year, right? So this is not complicated. Missing a lot of school, not good for students. If you miss 10%, we just said that's a good measurement to figure out how many are really kind of persistently absent. So that's the number.
Okay, so, and now, how much has the extent of chronic absenteeism, you know, I suppose in any given year, a normal year, a school would report that 3% of its students were absent in the past year more than 10% of the time. Therefore, 3% were chronically absent.
That's right. That's how it would be.
Okay. So what is it now?
It's almost 10x that. It's more than 1 in 4. We actually don't have current data for this year because the states have to wait until the end of this year until they know. Last year, it was 26.4%. And hoping this year that it's below 1 in 4,
we'll see. That's amazing. 25% of our students are absent more than 10% of the time.
That's 25% of more than 25% of K-12 students. So this is not just high school students. That's the whole kit and caboodle.
And in a good year, the year away it should be, what should that number be?
Well, you know, the baseline pre-pandemic was 15%.
Okay.
But we didn't call that a good year. Telling them that was a good year. The people who were watching this were saying, hold on a second, 1 in 6? 1 in 6 kids missed a tenth of the school year? That seems like a lot. It is a lot. We should get that number down. We shouldn't be satisfied. But in my mind, the near-term goal is let's at least get back to the pre-pandemic numbers because it is a lot lower than it is today.
Okay. So, and now we'll just ask, why are you, scholar at AEI, the source of the data on this as opposed to the Department of Education or somebody else?
Yeah, the Department of Education does have some data on this, and they've put it together. But look, you kind of have to understand the nature of the data gathering complex. There's a bunch of states. The states gather the data. That has to be sort of delivered to the department. They have to do their things. It takes a while for them to process it. I'm too impatient to wait for that. So on the chronic absenteeism front, I go to the states. As soon as they release their data, I put it up on the Return to Learn tracker so you can see how that state is progressing. So I'm trying to get this in as close to real time as states will allow me to. And the reason that this is so important is because it increased so dramatically over the pandemic. And we do not have a long time to deal with this because it deals with habits and routines. And the longer the habits and routines get used to, we don't have to go to school that often, the longer term and more stubborn this problem is going to be.
Yeah, it's interesting you should say that you know the data is collected by the schools, but you go get it, and the thing that you do with it is you assemble it, you collect it, you compare it across districts and all that, and across states. But the thing about education data that resides in state departments of education or even federal departments of education, and certainly in school districts, is they have it, but they don't like telling anybody about it.
Well, you know, they're all over the map. I literally, just before I came down here, the last email I sent was to an unnamed state who has still not sent me chronic absenteeism from last school year. So they're almost 11 months out, and it's a large state, and they should get on it. There are some other states that are doing a bang-up job on this. So Rhode Island, they have dashboards up on where they are so far this year. On track. So that, you know, that
okay,
is really
fair.
Some
I
great
like that.
Work.
I like
Connecticut's
that.
Doing some good work.
You see, I was giving this sort of classic conservative condemnation of public education. And Nat is saying it's really, they're not all that bad.
Well, I think we should condemn some, and I think that we should praise others.
Okay,
so, you know, I really think that the work that is being done to put this data out there such that it's actionable, such that we can focus on this, is not a necessary, but it is, I mean, not a sufficient, but it is a necessary part of this solution because most people are going to say, well, you know, it's the test scores. It's the pandemic sort of feelings of belonging. No, it's the chronic absenteeism that is the number one problem in public education today. And I am an evangelist for making sure that everyone knows it because it's not just schools that have to change here. It's everyone from governors down to parents and students.
Okay, I completely agree. And we'll get to how to change it and how to use leadership to change it. But I wanted to ask you a question about where is it, you know, 26% or 25% nationwide means it's probably worse in some places and better in other places. So take us down that line.
Well, first, let's just do it temporally. So pre-pandemic, it was 15%. In 2021, 2022, which is the first post-pandemic data that I think is pretty reliable, it was 29%. And then it fell about 2 percentage points between 2022 and 2023. And that's important because in 2022, we had Omicron. That's when we had the Omicron pandemic. So, look, we keep kids home when they're sick. And it's true that during Omicron, there was a lot of sickness out there. So there was much better explanation for why we might have higher chronic absenteeism in 2022. I was hoping it would fall substantially, and it fell 2 points. So just temporally, we're not descending anywhere near as fast as we need to.
Okay, we got that. But now tell me again, where is it really bad and where is it not so bad?
Yeah, it depends on how you want to talk about this. So in absolute terms, it's worse for disadvantaged districts. If you're a low-achieving district, you have much bigger problem with chronic absenteeism. And if you are high poverty, high minority, you know, kind of the usual suspects in education research,
So
that's
the
where
problem
you're having a harder time.
Is more severe in lower income districts.
That's right. But here's the thing about
it. So that means 35 or 40%.
That's right. I mean, in 2022, 39% of all African-American students in the U.S. were chronically absent.
Ugh.
I mean, it's just sort of gobsmacking numbers. And I think we need to hold that in our hand on the one hand. But when you look at the change, those kinds of students and districts also had higher chronic absenteeism before the pandemic. So they do have a bigger problem in some sectors, but the change, the percentage change, was very even. And I think that says a lot about what the nature of the problem is.
Okay. Now, one of the things I always like to ask about is there a distinction in this topic between a private or religious-based schools or charter schools versus traditionally public schools?
That is an excellent question. On the charters, we have some data, but it's not always tracked perfectly. In California, charters were a little better, not dramatically better. There's even tougher data to get, certainly not nationwide, on private schools. In Indiana, I can say, well, private schools saw similar proportional increases, but again, they had lower amounts of chronic absenteeism. This is both before and after the pandemic. So charters are a little better. Private schools seem to be doing substantially better. Increases for both. Imperfect data across both those groups.
Religious, you're mulking, putting the private and religious all together.
I can't divide those out with the data I've got.
All right, so those schools are in charter, it's a mixed bag, but in private schools, it looks like they're better. And of course, they started better. They got worse, just like everybody else, but now they've come back to better than the rest of the public schools.
Well, yes, they're faring better, but they all the increase that we saw across the board, it really kind of brought up rates proportionately in all those groups.
Okay, what about why is this terrible? I mean, tell me about the educational experience for the kids in school and the kids out of school that's affected by having 20% of your fellow classmates not there more than 10% of the time.
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the ways it's not good is for kids, right? I mean, if you miss a bunch of school, then you're going to not get a lot of the benefits from school. And not only that, but there's just habits, right? Some of these good habits of showing up every day, rinse and repeat, work hard. You know, I mean, these are the same things that do well in other institutions like work and church and family, for that matter, right? So certainly there's individual impacts, but it's not just individual. The absenteeism, we know from prior research, can be kind of contagious. So if one kid is absent in a class, then his classmates are more likely to be absent later on that week. And there's certainly effects on classrooms. So this is not just a peer effect, but, you know, when I was a teacher, you have a bunch of kids absent, you got a lot more work to do.
Yeah.
You got to catch them up, and there's just more discontinuity. You know, sort of coherence and is just good for classes. It's good for teachers, and a lot of instability in attendance interrupts coherence.
Right. And just to be clear, it just means you got a kid who hasn't been there for a while, and you've got to catch them up while at the same time keeping the ones that are there moving forward. It completely interrupts the lesson plan for a teacher. I mean, it's got to be enormously frustrating for the teachers that have to deal with it.
I think it is. And, you know, here's the difference between a 15% chronic absent rate and a 25% is that the frequency with which you're getting hit with a couple of absences is just a lot more because you just have a greater pool. And you know, look, there's no magic about the chronic absenteeism 10% number. What we're seeing is absences kind of across the board go up. And so it's overall absences that are okay. That are going up for all kinds of reasons.
All right. So when I saw you present on this recently, you had actually a pretty simple solution to it, which was leadership, superintendents, politicians, commissioners of education, public relations campaigns that just sent a message, you got to be in school.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely vital. I'm not seeing as much of it as I think we need. I want to be clear. I don't think that's enough. I just don't think it gets done unless we have the leadership banging the gong on this to pierce parent behaviors. Because, look, this is pretty base behaviors. It's not like, well, let's give them a math lesson and we'll fix this. The importance of school is not less than it was before the pandemic. The importance of showing up routinely is important for your kid. It's part of your moral and legal duty as a parent with a kid enrolled in school. And so I think that we need authorities who are willing to talk muscularly enough to pierce sort of this malaise over attendance, which is not everywhere, but it's affecting enough people that the numbers are going up everywhere.
So that sounds like something that I like, and people who know me know that I like, you know, preaching about values, describing better behavior, talking about culture. Do principals and superintendents, are they just afraid of the accusation of paternalism and they won't do it?
I don't know. It's hard to know exactly what school leaders are willing to do. I think that with a little wind at your back from the governor breathing down your neck and the superintendent saying, this is job one, I think it's easier for a building level principal to take a muscular stand on it. And the converse is also true. If you don't have somebody sort of at the next rung of the ladder making your job easier by giving you the cover to push your people hard, I think that's harder, both in the teacher zone, because we're going to have to push teachers on this, and certainly in the parent and student zone, where I think there's too often sort of this attitude towards schools of, well, what are you going to do for me? As opposed to, what do I need to do to be a part of this community?
So the effect is learning loss, failure to master certain skills, right? I presume that the ultimate effect on a student is that, or for a group of students that are in this situation. What's the evidence on that?
Well, we know from pre-pandemic research, and it's important to just note this, research takes time. It takes time to get outcomes. It hasn't been that long since the pandemic. So most of what we know about absenteeism is based on this pre-pandemic research.
Yep, yep.
But we know that, your chronic absenteeism when you're in middle school is one of the best predictors of whether you're going to graduate high school. Right? I mean, if you're chronically absent, you are just much more likely to not complete. And that sort of makes sense, but it's just a potent indicator.
Right.
It's also a potent indicator of your long-term learning benefits. This all makes sense. If school is good, inconsistent attendance probably is going to be worse for the things that school is good for. And I think that holds true, and I think it's going to continue to hold true. The other aspect here is that we had learning loss that stemmed from the rotor wash that we went through during the pandemic. And what we need to do now for the students who went through that is help them catch up from the losses that weren't really due to chronic absenteeism. But now chronic absenteeism is the stumbling block in the way of those students. And unfortunately, the kinds of districts that had the biggest learning loss and the kinds of students that did are the same kinds of districts and students that tend to have higher percentages of absenteeism.
So just to do a counterfactual, or sort of maybe there's another aspect of this that is, we are in a very tight labor market. Every employer in America is looking for workers, especially and including entry-level workers. I'm a junior in high school. I'm not really happy with the education I'm getting. There are certain aspects of the school environment that are not healthy for me for whatever reason. I discover nobody cares whether I show up or not, and I get a job paying $22 an hour, and I'm not going to school because of that. How does that make you feel?
Well, I think that that's a poor set of decisions for almost any kid out there. And look, my son has three more days of school left as we're talking right now. And
yes,
today he was like, these last days of school are a waste of time. I want to go out and work, because he's a worker bee. So
yeah, okay.
I get it.
Yeah.
But I said, stay in and complete, because this is important. We're going to finish the course. And I absolutely think that is the case for a high achieving high school student to the kid who just needs to clear the bar. Because getting that paper, especially towards the end of your career, is linked to all kinds of positive outcomes. So finish the course is what I would say. The other thing I would say is we're seeing these increases across the board. So when I say chronic absenteeism is up, yeah, it's up for high school, but it's proportionally up for second and third graders. And I'm pretty sure that very few of them are employed. And if they are, we have different issues to deal with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's really, really troubling data. And just so our listeners know, Nat is the foremost expert on this. His work has been covered all over the place, including a very prominent page one, above the fold lead story in the New York Times. And so all of us at AAI are just enormously proud of this sort of core research, discovering facts and bringing them to light work that Nat has done that's exposed a very serious problem that now has everyone concerned about and trying to do something about. And we don't know the final statistics for this year yet, but you're hopeful that – do you think you're having an impact on getting people to change behavior?
I do. We are able to amass a lot of attention to it. We are not getting quieter. We're we're trying to get louder over this summer, because really September starts another school year, and it, or August, as the case may be. And this is, we are running out of time to turn this around. This cannot, we cannot allow this to become a new normal for American schools. That would be terrible, not in sort of a pandemic recovery, we have to catch up. In terms of the long-term productivity of American schools, that would be a long-term erosion of how productive our schools are if we got used to kids not showing up regularly.
Right, and I want our listeners to understand that while this, our interest in this topic was piqued by what happened during the pandemic and the wake of the pandemic, this is not a pandemic story. This is not about the mistakes we made during the pandemic. This is a story about the lingering effects of things that happened in the pandemic and a big problem that exists today. This isn't about, gee, I wish, you know, the schools hadn't been closed for so long. We're not talking about that. We can talk about that if you want to, but we're talking about an ongoing existing problem that exists today that one could say has nothing to do with pandemic policy anymore. It has to do with how we run schools today.
And Robert, you know, I gathered that data on which schools were closed during the pandemic.
Yes.
So if that was the big difference maker, I promise we would have talked to about that already in this podcast, because it took a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to get that data together. And it's not that it's not that the closures made no difference, but it was a relatively small difference on this thing. Yeah. And you're absolutely right. This is an ongoing problem. This is today's problem, not yesterday's.
Okay. All right. So when we asked you to come on the show, we talked about another topic. So we're going to shift for just a minute, because I do, it does relate to the current presidential campaign, because one of the candidates, President Biden, has made a big issue of this. And because you're so knowledgeable of this, I want to not miss the opportunity to just ask you, where are you on, you know, it's clear that the President Biden and his people are determined to forgive student debt for as many students as possible. And I guess, is that good policy?
So absolutely not. And Robert, I track everything. So I've actually tracked the amount of debt that has gone out. So this is the amount of debt that has been forgiven from the U.S. Treasury already. There's more coming, or in the offing anyway. We'll see. But this is over the Trump and Biden administrations. All in, a lot of this was the payment pause, but I still think that's a lot of foregone money from the Treasury. All in, it's we're almost to $400 billion. We're at $397.5 billion, which is just a that's actual real money, even if you're the U.S. government.
Yeah. Okay. So they've forgiven a lot of debt, but is that, why is that not good?
Well, you know, forgiving debt for sort of a narrow set of people who have particular problems, they had particular complaints for being defrauded. We have some measures to do that already in place. I think the Biden administration has basically taken every lever available to them and opened it up as to the nth degree to do as much as is legal or arguably legal as far as forgiving student debt. And look, it's tough when someone says, well, you know, they forgave $6 billion the other day for the Art Institute borrowers. And that was really kind of a scandalous corporation. Okay, I got you there. There were some bad actors. I don't know if all $6 billion needs to be forgiven, but that's sort of the attitude every time. You know, we can have those discussions once or twice, but when you get to $400 billion, somebody's got to sort of pay the piper on this. And right now, I think we need some sort of limiting principle on the Biden administration wherever we can get it.
But an argument is that people who could pay, who made a fair loan agreement with whoever was lending, as the federal government, got a job that pays them enough money to afford, you know, their monthly payment, it's that they're being forgiven. People that are perfectly fine, aren't complaining, and were regular and, you know, paid as agreed borrowers. Is that what he's doing? He's forgiving people that were in fine shape?
I think that For to hear him tell it, he would say, we're forgiving people who have lots of needs, and we're not going to miss any of them. And if we have to forgive the loans of a few hundred thousand other people, then we're willing to do that. And so that's the full bore nature of what we're looking at. Yeah. And it is also true, it should be said, that they did try and forgive, $10,000 to $20,000 worth of debt across the board for everyone. And the Supreme Court said they could not do that. And the next day they said, well, we have another legal route that we're going to try to do this on. So it is a policy in search of a legally defensible conduit, not a policy that Congress has certainly signed on to.
Yeah, I actually, I'm glad you made that final point because, the respect for institutions, respect for the law, respect for, the proper separation of powers and the limitations on the power of the presidency. This conversation is dominated right now in America by attacks at the Republicans and President Trump. And certainly they deserve some attacks on those scores for a variety of reasons. But it doesn't help the case that you're making in that regard to have this happening where the president just seems to just want to ignore a ruling of the Supreme Court.
Well, I mean, look, Biden has said multiple times, show me your budget, I'll show you your priorities. Well, on this score, the federal government spent far less on K-12 education over the pandemic than loans it forgave over the pandemic. I don't see the loans as a particular pandemic problem. I think if you look at his budget, you'll see the priorities that for President Biden, the loans are the priority.
Over K-12 education.
Well, it's a pretty clear distinction when you look at how much money has gone out from the federal government or been foregone for the two.
Okay. Well, with that, we're going to call it a day and thank Nat Malkus for both his work and for participating in One-on-One with Robert Doerr. And we'll see you next time.